everybody. Welcome back to my channel. Thanks so much for tuning in. My name is Dana Trupiana, and I cover infamous gangsters every week in a true crime-like format. My show, Mob Times, comes out every Tuesday morning around 7 a.m. I don't know. We've been playing with it. Well, it's Tuesday, and it's somewhere around 7, so here I am. If you're new here, welcome. If you've been here before, I hope you already know how much I love you guys. I love interacting with you. And I love that you're a part of this little family that I've built around me. So thank you so much for all of your love and support. So how has everybody been doing? I made this video before Christmas, but when it comes out, yesterday will have been Christmas. So how was everybody's holidays? Let me know in the comments if you went home, if you got to spend some time with family, if you got to do anything fun, got anything fun for a present. Let's talk about it. Me, personally, I am under freaking water trying to get presents together. Christmas is always so much pressure for me. I mean, a Tuesday is also always a lot of pressure for me, so it doesn't really mean much that I feel pressured. But if you add any tiny little thing into my itinerary, like Christmas shopping, I'm just all sorts of out of whack, so I am all over the place right now. So I did my 10K giveaway yesterday, and it was amazing. Congratulations again to Uncle Eddie on winning the $100. I transferred it to him while I was in the live, and he confirmed that he received it in the live chat. It was such a good time hanging out with you guys. I absolutely loved it. I also love that I hit 11K before I could do my 10K giveaway. And as I stated multiple times on the live, I will be doing a $100 giveaway for every 10K that I hit from now on. So right now I'm at 11K. When I hit 20K, I'll do a $100 giveaway. Same thing for 30K, 40K, you get the picture. So if you didn't win yesterday, don't be discouraged. Hopefully we'll be doing it again really soon and you can maybe win next time. If you notice something weird with my face, I have been doing a little stuff with it. You might catch a glimpse of bruises if I turn a certain way, but I feel like I did a pretty good job with the cover-up, so I don't think you will, but you might. I got injections for a few reasons. First of all, I'm old as hell. And second of all, I got a pretty bad injury to my face when I was in the military, and I have kind of hated looking in the mirror since. So these injections really help to make it so that the scar and the lines from the scar that I have are not as noticeable. This is the first time I've done it, but I'm really loving it so far, and it helps my mental health a lot to look in the mirror and not have a bad memory staring back at me, so I'm really happy with it. Okay, so anyways, let's talk about my recent activity. Recently, a few weeks ago, I put an episode out about a case that I am personally involved in. And I always told you guys that I was going to release that video, but I was going to wait until I hit 100K followers. Well, right now, I just hit 11K, so why did I release it so early? Well, that's because another creator picked it up. I'm not going to go back through it or anything, but if you guys haven't seen my video on Billy Donahue, please go watch it. If you want to watch this video and then put that video as the next in your queue, I totally respect that, but please make sure that you've gone and watched that video at some point. More than any other video that I've ever done and directed you guys towards, this one needs your attention and interaction more than anything. So once again, a public plea, if you haven't yet, please go watch that video, interact with it, comment, like, share, whatever you guys can do, I'd really appreciate it. One last thing on the agenda before we move on to the episode, subscribers. Even though I talk to you guys about this every week, I'm still lagging like crazy on subscribers. I'm so happy to have hit 11K, but I still have about 20% of the people that view each of my videos being a subscriber. If you're watching this video, please look below me. See that red button that says subscribe? If it's a red button and it says subscribe and it's not a gray button that says subscribed, please hit the button and subscribe. It costs absolutely nothing, I won't bother you, and it means a lot to my channel. So if you guys can, I would really appreciate it if you subscribed. Thanks so much. Okay, so our episode today is going to be based on an infamous African-American gangster, policy runner, and bootlegger. And I'm so excited for it. Theodore L. Teddy Roe, popularly known as Teddy, was born on August 26, 1898, in Galliano, Louisiana. His parents, George Roe and Hallie Davis, were African-American sharecroppers, and Teddy was one of seven children in the family. They had Creole, African-American, and Italian ancestry in their blood. The Italian ancestry isn't necessary, but obviously I like it because, you know, I do nothing but cover Italians. Growing up in rural Louisiana, Teddy and his siblings would have experienced the challenges of poverty and discrimination that were all too common for African Americans in the South during the early 20th century. He was raised primarily in Little Rock, Arkansas, which is where the family moved shortly after he was born. So he was like really young when they moved to Little Rock. Sharecropping was a difficult and often exploitative way of life, with little opportunity for advancement or education. And both of his parents were sharecroppers. They were tenant farmers who could not own their own land, so they worked for others to make ends meet. The family lived in extreme poverty while Teddy grew up, and it was often hard to put food on the table. Life in Little Rock was challenging for the Roe family, and Arkansas, like much of the South, was deeply segregated and marked by racial inequality. African Americans faced limited opportunities for education and employment, and they were often the subject of discrimination and violence. Teddy often incurred discrimination in addition to the difficulties that him and his family and the entire community regularly faced. In many areas of society, including public places like schools and workplaces, as well as housing and employment, Jim Crow legislation of the era imposed segregation and discrimination. Killings and other acts of brutality against African Americans were also frequent, and most of the time, they went unpunished. Like many African American children in the South during this time, Teddy received no formal education, and instead, he spent a lot of his childhood working in the fields with his family. Despite the challenges, Teddy was a bright and curious child who had so many interests about life, and he was ready for anything. He loved to explore and had a wild imagination. He was interested in learning, and he was determined to find a way to improve his circumstances, and that of generations to come. Not only was he willing to work his ass off and fight his way out of poverty for his own sake, but for the sake of his family and his community as well. When he was old enough, he began doing odd jobs for a local tailor in order to earn money and gain some new skills. Through these jobs, he learned the valuable skill of sewing, which would serve him really well in the future. Teddy began making his own clothes, which was huge because the family faced poverty. That's pretty much the only way that he could get clothes. So the fact that he was able to make his own clothes, and I'm assuming he also made clothes for his siblings as well. He also became interested in boxing and began training as an amateur boxer. When he got a bit older, I feel like I don't even have to tell you guys this anymore. You already know what's coming. We've got a man who, obviously, because I'm covering him, is gonna go straight into a life of crime. And we've got the Roaring Twenties. Add them together, and what do you have? That's right, ladies and gentlemen, you've got yourself a bootlegger. Teddy started selling illegal alcohol as soon as Prohibition started, putting him around 22 years old when Prohibition was enacted, and around 36 when it was officially repealed in 1933. It was a very dangerous and very risky business at the time, but Theodore was determined to succeed within it. As he got deeper into the world of bootlegging, he gained a notorious reputation as a colorful racketeer. He did really well, and people always remembered any kind of business that they had with him because he was really professional, but he also had a very big personality. Being that he was known for his charm and his charisma, it was easy for people to remember him. It was also a lot easier for Teddy to get by in business because he was able to pass for white despite being a black man, and being able to pass for white allowed him to get further in business than if he wasn't able to. In those days, being a black bootlegger was a really dangerous proposition, and Theodore knew that he had to be careful if he wanted to stay alive. He made a shit ton of money in the bootlegging industry, but his career in bootlegging ended after only a few years. He decided to leave his old life behind and move to Detroit to work in the auto industry. Now, this part is purely conjecture. Like, this is literally just me telling you what I think. I don't see this written anywhere at all, but I'm pretty sure no one's ever written it. I don't know how nobody's ever, like, guessed it or assumed that this was the case. But this is what I'm assuming happened. It looks like the reason that Teddy moved out of bootlegging and went into the more legit auto industry is because he had recently gotten married. People report that he got married, people report that he cut his bootlegging career short, but nobody ever put two and two together and said, like, oh, maybe his wife didn't like him in the illegal bootlegging game, and maybe she told him, like, I'll marry you, but you gotta get out of bootlegging. It's too dangerous. I don't want you to do it anymore. So, personally, I think that's what got him out of it. Because if you're making all this kind of money, especially if you grew up in poverty, you're not gonna walk away from it unless you have a very good reason to do so. Teddy's reason for doing so would be when he met the woman that would become his wife, Carrie Givens. They married on December 17th, 1924, in Little Rock, Arkansas. 1924 is right about the time that he decided to move out of Arkansas and move to Detroit. So while a lot of sites say, like, hey, we can't figure out why he left bootlegging, we can't figure out why he went to Detroit, personally, I think it's pretty clear to see what his motivation to get out of crime was. But again, I've never seen it written anywhere, so it's entirely possible that I'm wrong. The couple would go on to live with Carrie's mom, Betty Givens, forever. There are census records from all the way into the 50s listing the three as living together. And this is a super weird thing. I just wanted to mention it at the beginning because I don't know what to make of it. I really don't know if the couple ever had any children. Ancestry.com swears that the couple never had any children, and I can't find anything that says anything about them having children or more than one mention of a child of theirs. I saw one mention on one website of a Rick Rowe, a DEA agent that was Theodore Rowe's son. And even that, again, I only saw it listed in one place on one page once in the entire internet. When I look at census data, there's never any mention of the couple living with a child, and nobody but the couple and the mother-in-law were ever mentioned as living at a residence together. So, I really don't know. I think that this one website that reported Rick Rowe, I think it was a typo, and I think Rick Rowe had to be his nephew or something, because it just doesn't make sense. There would be more mention of his son other than one little corner of the internet. Like, there's nothing. Ancestry, I did so much research to try to find a kid, and I could not. So, I'm thinking that Rick Rowe was his nephew, and this website just inaccurately listed him as their child. Again, there is no way it would be mentioned one time on one obscure article that he had a kid and never again anywhere else, and there's no way that this kid wouldn't be reported on census data. So the couple moved to Detroit, and Teddy went into the auto industry. Detroit was a bustling city in those days, thanks to a thriving automobile industry. Theodore got a job in one of the automobile plants, and he worked really hard to make an entirely new, legit life for himself. So, I was doing research, and I was gonna go into the whole thing about Detroit and the history of the city, and that led me down a rabbit hole of Detroit's big three automotive companies. But I decided not to add that part in because it's really long, and I don't think you guys are really interested in it. But I do want to share one piece of information that I fell into while I was in this rabbit hole. Stellantis North America, the umbrella company that owns Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, Ram, all of those companies. I want to talk about it for a second because, like, I never knew that this company existed before. I knew that Jeep, Dodge, Ram were all owned by the same company because whenever you see used car dealerships, you always see like Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, Ram, like it's they're always sold together as used cars. But have you guys ever heard of the name Stellantis? Apparently, it's a large global company, and the name Chrysler is just one of the names that they sell vehicles under in America. Like, the more you know, I mean, I never heard of it. I'm like BBC over here giving world news to the ignorant, uneducated Americans that never hear anything about world events outside of America. So what I'm trying to say is, you're welcome. From one ignorant American to another, Stellantis owns those companies. Now you know. At the age of 31, Roe decided to move to Chicago in search of a better job opportunity, and he landed a job with a tailor in the south side of the city. He had previously been working for a tailor in Arkansas, and he felt really confident that he could make a name for himself in the bustling city of Chicago if he started working for a tailor. He was able to secure a position working for an African-American tailor named Edward P. Jones, and he is going to be a big part of today's story. Once again, what I'm about to say is purely my own opinion, me jumping to conclusions, and me trying to figure out why he made the moves that he made. Honestly, he probably started seeking a job in a different place outside of Detroit because of how hard Detroit was hit with the Great Depression. And once again, this is something that's not written anywhere. Nobody guesses this. Nobody goes on the internet and tries to figure out why he did the things he did. So this is purely just coming from me and my idea of why he would leave Detroit and go to Chicago. Since Detroit was more or less built and sustaining on the production of automobiles, and since people in the Great Depression couldn't afford food, no less to buy a car, the city was hit really, really hard from the Great Depression. Once again, I don't see it mentioned anywhere that this is why he moved, but I find it really hard to imagine that it's a coincidence that he moved when he was 31 years old, putting the year at 1929. And the stock market crashed in October of 1929, leading to most of the city's employees losing their job virtually overnight. Even if they were lucky enough to keep their job, the average citizen working in the automobile industry had a salary of $1,600 per year in 1929, and then in 1933, it was only $1,000. So even if you did keep your job by some miracle, your salary was getting cut way down. So I don't really know which happened to him, but I'm assuming he left Detroit because he either got fired from his job or he kept his job, but his salary was cut and he wasn't able to survive on it. But either way, we're probably seeing him seek employment in a different city that wasn't hit as hard as Detroit was by the Great Depression. This new job that he got in Chicago was a huge step up for him. And he now had a more stable and consistent job, and he actually had potential for growth and advancement, which is something he never had in Detroit. As he worked with the tailor, Roe continued to hone his sewing skills, and he learned a lot more about sewing and the entire industry that it was in. He showed a very strong work ethic and a dedication to his craft, which impressed his employer. His employer started giving him more responsibilities and more opportunities within the shop, and Roe began to take on a lot more complex projects. Through his hard work and determination, Roe eventually became a skilled tailor in his own right. Like, the man was doing amazing things in Chicago. He was determined to use his talent and experience to build a successful career in the fashion industry. And aren't we all? Like, everybody is out here just trying to find the job that they enjoy doing. One of those jobs that, like, you wake up in the morning and you don't hate your life because you have to get out of bed and go do it, you know? It seems like this job was that for Roe, which had to be refreshing because the automotive industry definitely was not that for him. He definitely was not jumping out of bed in the morning excited to go to work in the automotive industry. Especially because he was probably working in a factory. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen any kind of like documentaries or anything of working in a factory at that time. But last week I did Tommy Lucchese and he got three of his fingers cut off in a factory. So I'm gonna go ahead and assume it wasn't the greatest working conditions. It wasn't the most fulfilling work for someone. So Teddy is really thriving now. Working for Edward Jones was a huge turning point in Teddy's career. He was able to apply the skills that he had learned in Arkansas and hone them under the guidance of an experienced tailor. Jones was a skilled tailor who had a really strong reputation for creating high-quality garments. Teddy knew that, and he was really eager to learn from him and to improve on his own craft. Teddy's time working for Edward P. Jones was also really significant because it allowed him to establish himself in Chicago's African-American community. Jones was a really well-respected figure in the community, and working for him gave Teddy the credibility and respectability that he definitely wouldn't have gotten if he had just moved into the city. He became known by people. When people would come to see Edward Jones, Edward would introduce Teddy to them, and it just made it a lot easier to blend into the community and become a well-known, respected person in the community. He was able to make connections and build relationships with other members of the community, which would later prove very beneficial in his career. In the early days of their working relationship, Jones saw potential in Rowe, and he decided to make him his very first runner. As a runner, Rowe's job was to sell lottery tickets to interested buyers in an illegal lottery game. This was a very profitable venture for Jones, who was able to make up to $2,000 a day in 1930. Just for some reference here, if that money was nowadays, it would be $35,000 he was making per day. $35,000 a day. He was able to set up such a powerful and successful gambling ring thanks to the protection that he had from politicians. In particular, he had Edward Joseph Kelly and Patrick Nash, who were a part of the Kelly-Nash machine, which was a political organization in Chicago that wielded considerable power and influence. They were known for their ability to protect businesses and individuals in exchange for their loyalty and financial support. So in other words, like crooked cops, like you pay me off, I'll make sure you don't get arrested, that kind of deal. Jones had aligned himself with this powerful group, which allowed him to operate his illegal lottery business with minimal interference from the authorities. Edward Jones also had a brother, and they operated this business together. The Jones brothers went from being as poor as church mice to millionaires, just making money through the policy racket. And they made sure to show their appreciation to the neighborhood. Unlike some people who make a lot of money and then just go off and do their own thing, they definitely put the money back into the community. They invested in the community, investing in legitimate businesses in the area. They had investments in grocery stores, variety stores, hotels, beauty parlors, haberdasheries, all kinds of businesses they had investments in, and that helped them be looked at as more legitimate. They provided capital for locally owned banks, and they hired a lot of people from the neighborhood to come work for them as runners, which created a huge job market during a time in the Depression era where jobs were scarce. You did not come upon a job during that time, especially because during the Depression era, African Americans were known to be the last hired and the first fired. The Jones brothers created an entire job market for African Americans from the community to come and work for them and be able to support their families during a time when a lot of people couldn't. The Jones brothers making money and then turning around and investing it into the community caught the attention of the community. The community noticed that they were putting money back into the community. They were spending all their money at locally owned shops. They were making loans to businesses. They were making sure that businesses kept their doors open. If somebody wanted to open a new business, they got money there. And that caught the eye of the community. Because people in the community appreciated that, people that wouldn't normally have bought lottery tickets did because they liked the Jones brothers. They liked that they invested the money back in. And because people in the community invested in the policy racket, it helped Jones's policy racket grow exponentially. Edward Joseph Kelly was a strong advocate for social reforms and community empowerment. So it was really easy for him to get behind Jones and what he was doing. Kelly established community centers and playgrounds. He provided safe spaces for children to play and promoted educational and recreational activities. By prioritizing the well-being and education of Chicago's youth, he aimed to create equal opportunities for all residents. Through this initiative, public housing projects were constructed to provide affordable houses for those in need. And this had a huge impact. It positively impacted the lives of thousands of people living in Chicago. It was really helpful. Theodore Rowe, as Jones's first runner, was responsible for finding buyers for this illegal lottery racket that they had set up. He likely went door to door, visited local businesses, and even approached people on the street trying to sell his product. The fact that Jones, who was working with his brother, George Jones, was able to make $2,000 a day through this enterprise is a huge testament to the popularity of the lottery in the community. People were willing to take a chance and buy tickets despite the risks involved. Jones and Rowe were able to capitalize on this demand and turn it into a profitable business. In the early 20th century, African American communities in Chicago and pretty much all other major cities in the United States faced significant challenges due to segregation and economic discrimination. Limited access to traditional banking and employment opportunities had a huge impact on these communities. It left these communities marginalized and economically disadvantaged. But during this time, the policy industry emerged as a significant source of income and financial support for a lot of African Americans in the community. Policy, also known as the numbers game, is what we've been talking about. It's what Jones created. It's what Rowe has been a runner for. It's an illegal lottery system that allows participants to place small bets on numbers that they choose. It was known as the poor man's gambling game. Policy kings, who were typically prominent figures from within the African American community, organized and operated these gambling networks. They would have runners who would go and collect bets. They would determine the winning numbers, and they would also distribute the payouts. Policy kings played a crucial role in providing financial stability to these neighborhoods. The money generated from the policy industry went back into the community. It served as a de facto banking system. Policy kings acted as unofficial banks, accepting deposits and providing loans to community members who were unable to access traditional banking due to discrimination. And these guys, they didn't do the shady shit that the Italians do. They didn't give a loan and it's a 50% interest rate weekly. It's not crazy things like that. They did loans that helped the community. And a lot of these guys weren't out there breaking kneecaps if the payments weren't made. Most of these policy kings invested their earnings in legitimate businesses in the area. They invested in car dealerships and churches and all the small locally owned stores in the African American community. These investments provided much needed employment opportunities, and it helped to stimulate the economic growth in these neighborhoods. The car dealerships, for example, not only offered employment, but also made automobiles more accessible to African Americans who faced discrimination when attempting to purchase a car from a mainstream dealership. So these industries are emerging because of a need. People from within the community, their needs aren't being met. So people from within the community make sure that those needs are met for people in their community. The churches that were funded by policy kings served as both religious and community centers. They provided spaces for worship, and they also had areas for social gatherings and community organizations. Also, these churches often hosted events and fundraisers in order to support various community initiatives, which would put money back into the schools and the social services in the neighborhood. While the policy industry was illegal, it played a very, very important role in supporting and helping African American communities during a time of economic hardships, and there was very limited opportunities. The policy kings acted as influential figures within their community. They provided financial resources, employment, and essential services that were otherwise denied to African Americans due to systematic racism and discrimination. In November of 1951, the government imposed a 10% tax on wagers in the policy game. This is super confusing to me because the policy game is illegal, and Roe would later be arrested and charged for operating a policy game. So how the hell can the government tax it? That's like saying they expect bank robbers to pay 10% of the money that they stole from the bank in taxes. Even the papers acknowledge that the income that the government saw from the policy rackets was far lower than the true total of gambling profits in Chicago. It just doesn't make sense. If you pay taxes, you're admitting that you illegally made money. I mean, I guess it's a good way that people could try to not go to jail for tax evasion. It just doesn't really make sense to me. Even while the taxes were such a small percentage of the actual revenue in the game, they collected $1.1 million in Northern Illinois in their first quarter that they imposed this tax, showing $11 million in policy bets. And that is a fraction of the actual policy bets that were placed. According to newspapers, once this tax was enacted, runners would collect 11 cents from somebody making a bet instead of the 10 cents per person's bet to account for this new tax that was put in place. The numbers were chosen pretty similarly to the way that they're chosen now. The drawing places would be changed often to make sure that the cops couldn't find them, bust it up, take the money, do any sketchy shit. But they had a wheel that would turn, and they would choose three numbers out of the wheel, and the person that had those three numbers was the winner. Theodore Roe was a businessman with a knack for making money, and by 1938, he was earning an impressive $10,000 per day. For scale, that's about $216,000 per day nowadays. With this kind of income, Roe was able to establish himself as a major player in the underground economy, and he attracted a significant following. But his success didn't go unnoticed, and the Chicago Outfit, a powerful criminal organization, took notice of him. The Outfit was kind of like the New York Mafia, just like an extension. The person that ran the Outfit had a seat on the commission with the five families in New York. So the commission, which is like the leader of the mafia, they have the five families in New York. The heads of those guys are on the commission. And then they have the head of the Outfit, which at the time that it was created was Al Capone. And then they have, I believe, Buffalo. I might be wrong there. No, I'm pretty sure it was Buffalo because Stefano Magadino was also on the commission. So I'm pretty sure it's Buffalo. Might be wrong there. The Outfit was known for its ruthless tactics and control over various illegal operations, such as gambling, extortion, and the entire prostitution ring of Chicago. People that watch my channel often, you guys already know what the Chicago Outfit is from my videos about Big Joe Colosimo, Al Capone, Tony Accardo, Mad Sam DiStefano, and Frank McAirline. We have talked about this group a lot. But for people that don't watch my channel a lot, or maybe this is your first episode, think of the five families of the mafia in New York, and now just pick one up and put it in Chicago. It's the same thing. Roe's connection to the Outfit was forged through his friendship with Sam Giancana, a capo in the organization who had shared a cell with Eddie Jones in federal prison. During their time together, they had become close friends, and Giancana was impressed by Jones's business acumen. He saw him as a potential ally in his quest for power and wealth. Jones was in prison and he's bragging about the scale of his gambling empire. He's talking to everybody about how rich he is, how lavishly he lives, and how much money he has invested in businesses in the area. Giancana just kind of sits back and listens while Jones goes on and on. And eventually, Jones even offers to bring Giancana on to his policy racket once they both get out of jail. After Giancana's release from prison in 1942, quickly made a name for himself within the Chicago Outfit. One of his first major accomplishments was convincing Outfit underboss Tony Accardo to take over the city's African-American policy lottery system. Giancana's crew played a key role in convincing the existing operators of the policy system to sell their business to the Outfit. This allowed the organization to take control of the profits from the lottery and expand its influence from within the city. So pretty much, I talked before about how there's a bunch of policy kings and they each have their own lottery. Well, the Italian mafia now wants to come in and take over. So they come in and they go to these policy kings and they start buying their businesses. And these policy kings, they probably still operate the business themselves. I highly doubt the Italian mafia has people coming into Chicago and doing the actual lottery. But they're the ones that are making the calls, and they're the ones that are getting the entire profit from the lottery. In 1946, the Jones brothers' lucrative number racket had grown to the point where they were earning $25 million a year in 1946. Because of this gigantic amount of money that they're making, their success is not going unnoticed by the outfit. The outfit is seeing an opportunity to make some money for themselves. One of their most successful ventures was the Floating Craps Game, a mobile gambling operation that traveled around the city and attracted high-stakes gamblers. The game was highly profitable, and the outfit's control over it allowed them to generate massive, massive amounts of income. They made sure that the game was always in a different spot all the time, making it virtually impossible for the authorities to track it down and take it down while it's going on. Honestly, I'm sure that they had heard about the policy racket before, but Giancana spending time in prison, listening to Jones go on and on about how much money he made and how lavishly he lived, made his ears perk up and alerted him that there was something that the Italian mafia had to get in on. So the fact that the Italian mafia is now trying to muscle in on the policy racket, that all goes back to Giancana and Edward Jones just sitting in jail, just bullshitting. And now you have an entire industry that's being taken over. And this isn't exactly an isolated incident either. If you watched my video on Stephanie St. Clair, you know exactly the same thing is going on in New York way before all of this. Dutch Schultz, who famously worked with and for the mafia, had been trying to muscle in on St. Clair and Bumpy Johnson's policy racket in Harlem for years before he was killed in 1935. So it's clear that the mafia is trying to come into predominantly African-American neighborhoods and take over their profitable policy numbers game. And it's nothing new when it starts happening in Chicago. Now, Giancana had this gangster in his crew, real dirtbag type. His name was Fat Leonard Caifano. While Giancana was doing his 28-month term for tax evasion, Caifano came to visit him. Giancana starts telling Caifano about this guy, Eddie Jones, who's in there for pretty much the same stretch as he's in there. Jones is doing a 29-month rap for bootlegging. And honestly, I'm sure while Giancana is talking, he's bringing up, and think about how Schultz took over that girl's policy racket in Harlem. We could totally do the same. Turns out, Caifano didn't just show up to visit Giancana because he's a good guy. Remember, we talked about this. Caifano is a dirtbag. Caifano wants to start up a vending machine business. But what do dirtbags never have, guys? That's right, money. Jones overhears Giancana's visit, and he tells Caifano he's gonna front the money to get a business between the two groups started up. So he lays out all the money for this vending machine business that Caifano wants to start. So, boom, awesome. There you go. Match made in heaven. The Policy Kings and the Chicago Syndicate are officially in business. Now, see, Jones, he's smart. He probably knows all about the shit that happened in Harlem, too. And he's not about to let that happen here. He puts up all the money for this vending machine business. And before you know it, 6 months have passed, and these guys have 12,000 vending machines up and running, and they're all making money, and they're all in his neighborhood. This little crew that they've started up between the two groups, they've got a crew of over 500 dudes under them. They've got jukeboxes, cigarette machines, pinball machines, and each of them are stocked up full of merchandise that fell off the back of the truck. The one thing that Jones will never ever do is offer these guys anything having anything to do with the policy racket. No, that is for him, his brothers, and Theodore Rowe. Now, even though the mafia has this great thing going with the jukeboxes and the cigarette boxes, and they're making all this money, they have a 500-man crew running, and they didn't put any money into this at all. this was all Jones's money. Even though they have this great thing going, the Chicago Syndicate approaches the Jones brothers and they demand a cut of the profits that they're seeing from the policy racket. They want in on that policy racket. And this is absolutely not up for debate. The brothers refuse to play ball and they refuse to give in to any of these demands. They've already done enough. They did everything that they did so they wouldn't have to give any of their policy racket up. This did not sit well with the mafia, and they decided that they were going to take matters into their own hands.
On May 11th, 1946, Eddie Jones was with his wife, his driver, and an accountant that worked for the store. Eddie and his wife decide that they're going to drop the accountant off at home. So they get to the accountant's house. She gets out of the car. Jones gets out of the car to escort her up to her door. And when he got back to the car from dropping her off at her door, they got ran up on. Two white males with white handkerchiefs covering their nose and mouth, with hats on and long trench coats on, ripped Jones out of the car. They held him at gunpoint, and he was dragged to the back of the car after a tussle with Jones's wife, Lydia. Now, because this turns into a huge scene, police officers that were sitting nearby noticed the commotion, and they start to pursue the car that had grabbed Jones because they were able to get him. In true ride-or-die fashion, Lydia gets behind the wheel and follows right behind the tail of the police car that's chasing the kidnappers. So in other words, if those cops weren't there, she'd be chasing the kidnappers. The men in the car that had kidnapped Jones broke out the back windshield and they start shooting at the officers that are pursuing them. One cop caught a bullet, which made them pull off the road, and the kidnappers ended up getting away. After days of absolutely no communication, so poor Lydia goes home, she saw her husband get kidnapped right in front of her, and then goes days with hearing nothing. So after days of no communication, the mafia reached out and they demanded a ransom of $250,000 for his safe return. They also demanded that if they returned Jones, that the Jones brothers hand over control of their policy racket to them for good. George Jones, Eddie's brother and another partner in the numbers racket, was left with a really difficult decision to make. He could either pay the ransom and hope that his brother would be returned safely, but like, these are criminals. There's nothing saying that if they say he's going to be returned, that he will. He could just give him $250,000 and still not get his brother. Or he could refuse to pay and risk his brother's life. George was able to negotiate the ransom down to $100,000, and he made a payment to ensure that his brother was returned safely. He paid the entire $100,000. The two brothers also agreed to hand over the entire policy racket. As soon as Eddie was returned, the FBI go full-blown search for these kidnappers. They had determined that the kidnappers were Grover Dilliard and Virgil Summers. Both men had a very long prison record, and Dilliard was a prior bodyguard for Bugs Moran, who we know is very connected to the American Mafia. Jones went to the media, and he described his time away. This was a really big deal because it was the first ever kidnapping of an African American in Chicago history. Jones described his stay as sort of a vacation. Despite being blindfolded with tape and having cotton shoved in his ears, he said, other than that, they really didn't mess with me. They didn't abuse me, torture me, nothing. It was fine. It was like I was chilling. It soon became known to the public that Giancana had ordered the kidnapping, proving to the entire community that Jones wasn't as invincible as he seemed, and also proving that he was willing to kill anybody that didn't cooperate. So not only was this a kidnapping, not only was he out for the money, so he initially wanted $250,000, he ended up getting $100,000, but this was a statement. The Jones brothers packed their things, they went and they grabbed $30 million, and they left for Mexico City, never to be heard from again. And the outfit didn't just completely screw these brothers over. They agreed to pay the Jones brothers $200,000 a year to get out and stay out of the policy game. But things didn't exactly go according to plan. After Jones was freed and they jetted off, Theodore Rowe is sitting there and he's like, absolutely not. You are not taking this policy. I built it. and I don't care who you are, you're not taking it. He refused to fulfill his part of the deal and surrender his share of the policy business. That was not going to Giancana's crew. It just wasn't happening. Roe wanted to retain control and not give up his portion of the profitable enterprise. Now, Giancana and Roe did not get along. Both were known to be boisterous, loud, brash men with loud mouths and no filter. Put two people like that together in a room, and most likely, they're not gonna click. Opposites attract, and these two were like trying to put two positive magnets together. You know how you do that and it pushes away? That's these two. They regularly had arguments, and one argument broke out between the two at a bar called the Boogie Woogie, a bar that was owned by Giancana, and ended up so heated that the two nearly started shooting at each other. As the two men left the bar, Giancana pulled one of those accidentally bumping into someone moves, you know, like how you guys are going opposite ways and Giancana just like threw a shoulder at him and you're like, oh God, I'm so sorry, but you're like not sorry. Yeah, he did that. When Roe asked Giancana what he was doing at a black bar, Giancana told him that he owned the bar. The next line that he uttered got Roe a little more than he did. Giancana said, I own it, and one day I'll own you. Roe grabbed him by the shirt, screaming that he was a dirty motherfucker, saying, I'll kill you. The altercation only ended when Giancana's men put guns into Roe's ribcage, which effectively calmed him down real quick. Giancana left with a quick, you're in over your head comment, like a snobby remark, and acted like he did something when he had other people do his dirty work for him. Roe's there fighting his own battle. He doesn't have his men taking care of it. But Giancana needed that. He needed his men to handle it, which just irritates me. So Jones and Roe, they're both very powerful Southside casino owners. This situation that I'm about to talk about, this is kind of what I'm assuming. So the mafia kidnapped Jones, said, you can't have him back unless we get $100,000 and you agree to never be in the policy game again. Jones says, okay, here's $100,000, I'll never be in the policy game again. But Roe was not about to give up his share of the policy racket. So the mafia decides that they're going to kidnap Theodore Roe. They send Leonard Fat Lenny Caifano. Roe shot Caifano to death. Fat Lenny Caifano was a made man in Giancana's group, and he was shot to death on June 19th, 1951. Before Jackie the Lackey Cerrone, another member of the outfit, frightened Big Jim Martin to Mexico with two bullets to the head, but not killing him, the outfit's takeover of the Southside policy game wasn't complete. The amount of money that this game created for the outfit was in the millions of dollars a year. When the lottery money began to pour in for the outfit after the gambling war, this gave Giancana greater attention. It's thought to have played a pretty significant role in him being anointed as the outfit's new leader in 1957. Accardo transitioned into semi-retirement. It's generally acknowledged that Accardo and Rica, they hold all the real authority in the outfit, but Giancana just took over as, like, the boss. The syndicate's activities flourished under the shield of Giancana's influence. Criminal enterprises ranging from illegal gambling operations and narcotics trafficking to extortion, labor racketeering, loan sharking, drug trafficking, and murder, it all thrived in the Chicago area. Law enforcement, at best, they turned a blind eye to this activity, and at worst, they facilitated in these illegal activities. The Chicago outfit's influence extended beyond Chicago, with connections to other crime families and syndicates across the United States. And again, the head of the Chicago outfit is also a member of the commission. There are several claims and allegations surrounding the involvement of Sam Giancana and his Chicago crime syndicate in John F. Kennedy's victory in the 1960 presidential election. There has never been any conclusive proof to show this. More than likely, what happened was JFK's dad was a member of the mafia, JFK wasn't winning. He went to Sam Giancana and other people in the mafia and said, I want my son to be president. They said, I bet we'll make him president. But when he becomes president, we want Lucky Luciano and Joe Adonis back in the United States. And that didn't happen, which is kind of what led to everything going downhill. But Sam Giancana and his Chicago outfit, it had a huge role in getting John F. Kennedy elected as president in 1960. Theodore Roe appeared before the Kefauver Senate Committee, estimating the profits that he earned from his policy game. Answering a question that an investigator had asked him, Roe replied that each drawing from the policy game brought about $12,000 worth of wagers. He explained every detail of the racket. He named 20-something past and present policy kings, and he confirmed that the Jones brothers and himself were all participants in the policy racket. Jones and Roe were arrested on policy racketeering conspiracy as they left the courtroom that day. They didn't spend long in prison, though. They were freed on bonds almost immediately. Roe was known to live a very lavish lifestyle along with his huge income. He spent $50,000 decorating his apartment at 5239 South Michigan Avenue, which the Chicago Defender described as lavish. He regularly wore custom suits, monogrammed silk shirts, alligator shoes, painted ties, and wide-brimmed hats. Even living the opulent lifestyle, Roe's personality, it never changed. He was known as someone that was quick to anger, had no filter on his mouth, and had no problem coming to blows if his mouth got him in a little too much trouble. And that never changed when he got more money. An attempt to kidnap Roe was authorized by Sam Giancana, who was aiming to take control of the entire Southside gambling operation. This was after Giancana had done literally everything else that he could think of. He offered Roe $250,000 to quit the racket, and when Roe responded that he'd rather die first, Giancana told him, "Well, my friend, you just might." Fat Lenny Caifano, a made man, was one of four men tasked with kidnapping him. They told him that they were state attorney police. I don't really think there is a such thing, but that's what they said they were. When Roe scoffed at them and demanded to see their ID, they dragged him out of the car. He pulled his gun as he was getting dragged out of the car and fired, piercing Caifano's temple. He shot again, catching a second mobster in the shoulder as he was running away, because once Caifano caught that bullet, they were out. Theodore Roe was detained by the Chicago Police Department and was accused of murder. Detectives Ed Landis and Richard Barrett with the Chicago Police Department took Roe to court the next day. The neighborhood of Chicago, they really liked Roe, according to Detective Barrett's son, DEA agent Rick Barrett. To them, Roe was Robin Hood. DEA agent Rick Barrett said that Dad always claimed that Roe was respected because he resisted caving to the outfit and to the Italians. You've heard the expression, a crook with honor? That, I suppose, sums up Roe. He wasn't a murderous thug like the drug lords who ruled the same neighborhood years later, nor was he a loudmouthed, flamboyant jerk. To protect Theodore Teddy Roe from potential harm orchestrated by the Chicago Mafia, he was placed under tight security at the Cook County Jail when he had been arrested for that murder. Recognizing the danger of poisoning, measures were taken to ensure that Roe's meals were prepared outside of the prison walls, minimizing the risk of any attempts of harm through his food. They knew that there was a lot of people from the outfit in the jail, and they were going to try to kill Roe while he was in there. The next day, Roe entered a plea of not guilty by reason of self-defense, and his defense team was able to discredit the prosecution by connecting themselves to the mob, which led to the suppression of crucial evidence in Roe's favor. Roe won the case in the end, but he was sent back to jail, and he was denied bail 6 times, both before and during the trial. So there was an entire trial. So there was weeks at a time that they had to get food made outside the prison walls and bring it in for Roe to make sure that he wasn't going to be killed by any of the outfit members that were in Gen Pop. Roe pounded his chest after winning the case, and he told the reporters, "They'll have to kill me to take me." Roe was convinced that his mentor and best friend, Eddie Jones, had turned on him and orchestrated this kidnapping with the outfit. He said that Jones had called him the day prior, asking him where he would be and at what time, and he said that wasn't a coincidence. So, now great, he's free and clear, not guilty, that's amazing, right? Not so right. The mafia is still out for blood, swearing to avenge Fat Lenny's death because you do not kill a made man. You just don't do it. And he had done that, even though he just did it as this made man was trying to kill him. It doesn't matter. He killed a made man, and the mafia wants him dead. The Chicago outfit saw Roe as not only someone who took out a made man, but the last remaining roadblock in their pursuit of taking over the gambling racket in the entire South Side. Roe was considered the Robin Hood of his time because he was a person that was recognized and remembered for his involvement in running a smooth operation, as well as his philanthropic activities. The neighborhood absolutely loved him for his refusal to bow down to the white mafia, for how he stood strong and never let up, taking a brave stand against such a huge syndicate that had so much power. He demonstrated a compassionate and empathetic nature by providing financial assistance to those in need, particularly when it came to hospital bills and funeral expenses. He was always the first person to give a large amount of money to cover those kinds of bills. One of the instances mentioned when people talk about him was involving an elderly woman who had won a sum of money from a shady, gangster-oriented gambling wheel in town. She had a lot of problems getting the money that she had won from this gambling wheel. Roe is mad. He's pissed at this injustice. The woman turned to Roe for help, and Roe listened. He took the initiative and rallied some of his associates to intervene on her behalf. Together, they approached the men that were involved in this gambling operation, and they convinced these guys to pay this woman what she won. She was supposed to get her rightful prize, and they made them pay her. Roe was known to actively engage with impoverished Black communities. He personally took to the streets, and he would hand out $50 bills to people that he saw that were in need. By directly interacting with people and offering financial assistance, he made a very positive impact on the lives of people that were facing such economic hardships. They were financially dying. And here's Roe handing $50 bills out, and he was just looked at as such a hero. He wanted to help alleviate their burdens, and he understood the challenges that were faced by this marginalized community. And he was going to do what he could to help bring this community back to a livable standard. Sam Giancana organized an extortion operation against Chicago's African-American bookmakers for a full month after Fat Lenny's death. Numerous people were attacked and fired at, while some just decided to leave the city for good. Roe continued to reside at his South Michigan Avenue mansion, protected from the mafia because he lived in the house with the family, and they don't go after family. On August 1st, 1952, Roe was diagnosed by his doctor with stomach cancer. He had an inoperable tumor. He was terminal. He was going to die. On August 4th, 1952, so 3 days after he got his diagnosis, two men from the Chicago outfit parked their car across the street. The gray 1950 Chevy was parked behind a building, so Roe wouldn't see this car parked there and be like, well, what the hell is going on? And the men hid themselves behind a billboard. Theodore Roe walked down South Michigan Avenue while wearing a three-piece suit and hat. He lived at 5239 South Michigan Avenue, so he had literally just walked out of his apartment. His car was parked in front of 5247 Michigan Avenue, so like a few houses down. As he went to get into his car, somebody called his name. When he turned to see who was calling him, he was shot with a shotgun and died at the scene. 5 shots were expended from a shotgun. Carrie, his wife that we talked about earlier, heard the commotion, looked out the window, and saw her husband lying dead on the sidewalk. She screamed out his name, but at 11 p.m., it was clear he wasn't getting up. She called the cops and ran outside, finding his body lying on the street. He had caught all 5 bullets to the back, face, and jaw. It wasn't really a surprise to Roe that he was being hunted. He had confided in a close associate recently, "I know they're going to kill me, but I would like to take one of them with me when they do." He carried a .38 caliber revolver in his pocket, but he didn't see this attack coming. He had no opportunity to use it. Like, they literally hid. I personally think it's pretty clear that Roe let himself be killed. He got news that he had inoperable cancer, and instead of dying a slow, painful death, he figured, why not go out as a martyr? He went out at night without any protection, knowing full well that the mafia was combing the streets looking for him. I totally believe that he allowed them to kill him, avoiding a lengthy battle with cancer. Following Jack Johnson's funeral in 1946, Roe's funeral was the largest funeral for an African American ever in Chicago. Roe was buried in a glittering bronze $5,000 casket, wearing a gunmetal gray suit, surrounded by $10,000 worth of flowers. Around 50,000 people lined the streets to view the 81-car funeral procession for Roe. Minister Clarence H. Cobb remarked at Roe's funeral, "He was a friend of man, and he had a pure heart." Giancana stated of Roe during an FBI wiretap in the early 1970s, "I'll say this, that guy died like a man. He was tough. To kill him was a fucking shame." Roe was the last big independent operator of the policy game, so there was no other way to go about this. After Roe's death, the policymaking in Chicago was fully taken over by the Chicago outfit and the Italian mafia, which is just such a friggin' shame, because that man fought till his dying breath to keep control of the policy game within the black community, and dirtbag Giancana had to come in and mess everything up because he was such a greedy dickhead. The only thing that makes me feel better about this is that the government ended up screwing the Chicago outfit the same way that they screwed Roe. I always said it was so messed up that the government had a lottery, because the lottery is literally the game that we've been talking about this entire episode. Like, you know how you can go to a gas station and buy a lottery ticket? That is this. Policy games is the lottery. And the government saw the African Americans making such a profit, and then they saw the mafia take it over. And what a profit they turned out. So what did they do? They made it illegal to operate these games. And then they came out with their own legal policy game, called it the lottery, and called it a voluntary tax. And you can go to a gas station anywhere in America and buy a lottery ticket. It's a real shame, though, in Chicago's case, because things did not work out the way that they did back in Theodore Roe's day. When Roe was controlling the policy, a huge amount of the money that he made went back into the community. Whether it was from him spending money at local stores, giving money to local neighbors, giving loans to businesses in the community, most of the money that he made stayed in Chicago, and it really helped that area flourish. That's a huge reason that Roe was known as the Robin Hood of the neighborhood. He made sure to take care of those around him. Now that the government took it over, that same area continues to pour money into the lottery, but a very, very small amount ever makes its way back to Chicago's South Side. So the way that the outfit came in and took over the policy from Roe is the same way the government came in and took over the policy from the outlet. Karma and justice for all. Giancana would go on to live a life completely wrapped up in the government. I won't go too much into it because I will 100% be doing an episode on him in the future, but he ended up being killed by the government when he was about to expose how the CIA was involved in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And again, I will be doing that episode. It's coming shortly, so you'll hear all about it. Roe's murder was never solved, but they heard Giancana talking on tape in the 70s about how he went out like a man and it was a shame to kill him. So after hearing that conversation, the police felt pretty confident that they had their answer on who killed him. That is all I have for this powerhouse of a gangster, Theodore Roe. Thanks so much for watching. Join me next week as I delve into the lives and legacies of some of the most fascinating and infamous gangsters in history. Please don't forget to like, share, subscribe, follow, comment, do all the things, and I'll see you next week. Bye.